You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this episode is recorded live at the Arena Theatre Wolverhampton with somebody who I've been trying to get on the show for a long time. We've managed to make the dates work at last, thanks in no small part to Danny Davies, who put this live event together. This comedian is someone who really deserves the title associated with this podcast. He really is an act who other comedians make an effort to see. I've loved him and followed his career for years. He's a Canadian who's been based in the UK for some time now. This is the superb Tom Stayd.
All right. So thanks, I get Tom. To sit here? Is that what I'm doing?
You get to sit here. That's what you're doing. And I'm going to ask you some questions for a bit. Thank you very much.
Okay. I thought they were pretty good. Fucking if I had a really nice crowd. you know you guys are a nice crowd, but you're a lecture crowd. You're like, teach me. I wish to learn. I'm not complete without my comedy knowledge.
So let's start by just for the benefit of the listener who won't hear any of that gig. Let's just recount. Well, I say gig as sort of, you know, 10 minutes worth of new material from both of us.
It was amateur night tonight.
It was, well, you know, let's talk about this, because there are, I think, from both of our points of view, there are several key reasons why that didn't launch into, you know, why the decision where we both went, okay, I'll do some new stuff and kind of try some things out.
You're just looking for that little bit of a laugh to know that it actually works if you put some effort into it. Like when I was doing those, I could tell the brain part.
Yep.
They love scooping out brains. It was a good comedy visual. fucking for sure. And then that was just a prelude. Is that the right word? Prelude? Did I use that right? I'm very uneducated.
Finish the sentence. We'll be able to tell you.
Okay. And then we went into the Nike sweatshop.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I eased him in to fucking whipping a small Chinese boy with a belt.
Yeah. So very skillfully as well.
Funny.
So that was a deliberate choice on your part to do like an easy visual dumb version of the idea before you get into the slightly harder to swallow stuff.
Well, to get into the wisdom of the joke. Do you know what I mean? I always go for wisdom over cleverness.
How do you mean?
Well, every great comedian I've ever seen, like some people write jokes. You said you had Gary here, and there's very great joke writers, and people love cleverness of the English language. You know, like if you can use it like Gary does, then you're a great joke writer. But for me, like I've never been that kind of a joke writer. For me, it's always, there's always just a tiny piece of wisdom behind everything I want to say, you know. So there, it's like my son said. My son was fabulous. He was, because he's 18 and he's really into life and analyzing everything. And I'm now just a ball of awareness walking around. I surpassed him, but he's
you're a ball of awareness.
We'll get into that later. Fucking, I'll show you how freaky I fucking am. But he said, you know, most people, he breaks it down as an 18-year-old kid. He goes, okay, intelligent people talk about events, and intelligent people talk about concepts. And he enjoys being around people who talk about concepts, because concepts everybody can relate to. Individual events, you had to be there. And most people tell individual events on stage, do you know what I mean? And unless there is that nugget of wisdom that you maybe have learned something from this event you're talking about to relate to them. But then again, then it would turn into a concept and all that sort of stuff of what actually happened at that event. But most people never go that far. And for me, I always like to look at my life like I'm watching a movie. Do you know what I mean? So I can see what I was thinking, the fear, everything in me. So when I'm talking about like what happened to me today or whatever, there's always a reason why I did it, and then I'll find out. As soon as I find out the reason why I did it, I assume most people would have that same reason, and that seems to bring people together for me in jokes and all that sort of stuff.
So first, thank you, because normally it takes us 20 minutes worth of an interview to get to stuff that's that bang on, and we're straight into the nitty gritty there, which is great. I'm very excited about that.
Okay.
When you say you're watching your life as a movie, do you mean that you try to have that in the back of your mind at all times, to be aware of what you're doing as you're doing it? Or is that, you mean something when you're looking back at events that have happened from the perspective of writing?
Say that to me one more time, Sue, sorry.
You said you were looking at your life, trying to see your life as a movie, to kind of look through it and see the common experience.
Right.
And I'm asking whether you do that, like you said, you're a big ball of awareness. I'm asking whether you look at your life like it's a movie as you're living it, or after an event has happened, you look back at it.
No, as I'm living it the whole time, as I'm walking the thing. Not only that, okay, not only do I look at it like it's a movie, because I think if you get too involved in your life, you can't see the funny. You know what I mean? Like, if you've ever talked to somebody who's very passionate about something, and they're real passionate, and then you throw in a little funny to them, they fucking just go right over it. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
You've banged them with a really fucking good tag on what they're saying, but they can't see it because they're so deep in their story, their life, and all that sort of stuff. And to me, I don't want to get that passionate about anything. You know, like, I mean, to me, not only do I watch my life like it's a movie, Stu, I watch it like I've watched it a second time. You know, I watched, and this is all shit I've learned in books and stuff like that. You know, it's not any wisdom that I'm throwing out there, but I don't know if everybody sees it this way. Do you know what I mean? So, but when you watch the movie for the first time, you're still really involved in the movie because you don't know what the ending is. You go through the ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs. But when you watch the movie like a second time, all of a sudden, yeah, you can see they're going through the trials and tribulations, and you're not that invested in it anymore. And you know it's all going to end up great, you know, so you're not so much a slave to your emotions that you can actually see the funny that is going on in front of you.
So if you're taking, I mean, that's fascinating, but if you're taking that approach to the living of your life, does that emotionally disconnect you from the living of your life, from the decisions that you're making?
Well, there's the question there, Stu. You got to decide. I always ask this question of people when I'm talking to them. I always go, is it your life or are you life? And if you decide that it is your life, you're going to be very involved in what you're doing. If you decide you are life, you're just kind of witnessing what's going on around you, and you're not such a slave to it. Do you know what I mean?
So, okay. So your the ability to do that, to be able to step outside and watch it going on.
Yeah.
It's, in fact, what you're saying really is that step outside isn't the right thing, because that implies a disconnection from it. But actually, mm-hmm. you're talking about being more involved.
Yeah,
in
really involved.
Ah, that's awesome. I love it.
But not personally involved in
okay.
it. You know what I mean? You still have to play the game. Don't get me wrong. Okay. You still have to, you cannot get out of this game. But for most comedians, they can't see what's in front of their fucking face. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So they miss that wisdom of what they're doing to me, and they go for the cleverness of everything. But for me, I always question, like, like why me and my I talk about my gal a lot, okay? And but what I do is I question why we know we're both psychos, and to try and talk about the psycho shit that we fucking do, and actually bring some light into why we did it. But if you're too passionately involved, you just I just don't think you can see it, you know? But that's only my opinion, Stu. That is so... I mean, you know as well as I do, there are so many different avenues you can go for comedy. I mean, comedy isn't just one thing. Comedy has got such a wide variety, but that's just the way I personally view it.
And is that way, which is very particular to you, and actually... Already just saying that, I can, and we'll talk a lot, I'm sure, about some of the bits of material that you've got. One of, I think, the defining factors of someone like you, and I think it applies to Mickey Flanagan as well, who you briefly mentioned earlier on, is I love. Yeah, exactly.
There's such a different spectrum, but that's only in profile, not in talent.
I think his approach is very similar to yours, because he isn't going for clever ideas. And I think Mickey is similar to you in that when you write down the material, it's hard to actually identify which bit of it is the joke. Do you know what I mean? The kind of the payoff, the ta-da, because it isn't about clever ideas. It's actually about something that's deeper and truer than that. I was listening back to a routine of yours, which when I first saw you, you were... You know, you used that routine for a long time, the plane crash stuff. So I was in the routine begins. So I was in a plane, and forgive me for misquoting it badly.
Don't worry, man. I can barely remember it either.
So I was in a plane crash, and here, if you want to know what happens in a plane crash, here's what you do. The pilot comes over the tower and he says, brace, brace. So then you put on your seatbelt, and I put my tray up, because I'd been listening. And that to me is, and then you did describe that whole thing of like, if you want to know what it's like to do this, here's what it is. And then within that, we see your perspective of describing
how ridiculous everything
is. How ridiculous it is, but it's not like
you're
going...
And why are you lying to us? Because I'm going to show you that if what you're saying is the truth, that everyone should survive a plane crash easy. It's just it's a lie and an ease. If this plane goes fucking down, who gives a fuck if you're wearing your seatbelt?
Yeah, exactly.
We're going down.
Exactly.
Okay, and that is it. No, nobody's reading a fucking card going, okay, we should be safe. Everybody, put your mask on the children first. Fuck that.
But I think that's exactly...
I don't even think that's the way. I think you're supposed to put it on yourself. That's where I went wrong. That's why we all died. Because I put my mask on my kid first, and then, fuck, we all died. I'm the only one that can swim. This cunt's drowning.
But I think that is exactly what distinguishes you from a lot of other comics, in that I think a lot of people would stop at... Hey, as if, you know what I mean, as if putting my mask on my kid first is going to save me. Do you know what I mean? They just come at it straight at the clever idea of it.
Yeah.
But you're saying all of that stuff without going, there's no, have you ever noticed? There's no, hey, this is my observation. The observation is kind of couched. The observation is woven through your description of how things are.
Yeah, yeah, and well, I don't know. Maybe that sounds good. Makes me sound smart, too. Fucking, I'm impressed, man. Well, wow, I might be smarter than I actually thought.
Well, this is...
I think you're right, yeah. I think dancing around something, and I think that there is no end to any joke. It's only as far as you can take it. You know, I mean, if you're just looking for a laugh and then move on, that's fine. That's what you're saying, right? You're saying they end it here, boom, ta-da, there's the laugh.
Yeah.
But you'll know as well as I do that I could be doing a joke for a really long time, and all of a sudden somebody will come up to you and go, I got a really great tag for that joke that you'd never even thought of, and all of a sudden they give you that tag, and all of a sudden that joke goes a little bit further, and from that tag, all of a sudden you can even see more of that joke, you know? So I don't think the joke ever ends. In fact, I'm one to sit there, I really like to stay on a topic for a long time, do you know what I mean? Because I think there's more laughs. It was what I was saying to actually Denny when I was the material to me isn't the funny, I'm the funny. the material itself is just sort of like my platform to be funny. But without me, it's dead in the fucking water. Do you know what I mean? Because anybody can write great jokes, but not everybody can perform them. Do you know? You know how many people have written great jokes that you see on stage and they die, and you know if you had that in your hands, mm-hmm. you would totally fucking destroy with it. But you can't steal it from this douchebag because he's just destroyed humor by not being a good comedian. And way to go, way to rob the world of your great idea because you're such a shitball.
How much of it is you talked about being smart, you know, or whether or not you're smart, that makes you sound smart. How much of it is intelligence and how much of it is instinct for you?
Instinct's a big one. Like, sometimes I get worried, man. Sometimes I get worried because I am a high school president dropout, okay?
What is a president dropout?
I was high school president, and I dropped out.
I suppose it does seem kind of obvious.
I mean,
when you say that.
I left office after I was found with a bottle of Kahlua at an airbang contest, and they booted me out for 10 days, and I just never fucking went back. And when you're talking about that, instinct to me is very important. I mean, intelligence, what is that? You know, what is intelligence? Is intelligence that you can retain everything you've ever read? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what makes Stephen Fry super intelligent, because every word he's ever read, he can remember. There's a lot of people like that. You know, for me, fuck, I read a book, like 2 weeks later, I'm wondering who the fucking author was. And but for the most part, I think for me, it's more wisdom of living the life the path that I've been going down. That's the wisdom that I have, and I think wisdom relates to people more than intelligence does. You know, I mean, we all like to feel smart, and we all like to feel intelligent, but everybody's intelligent to the point of what they've been exposed to. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean by that? So for me, I think, but everybody in this room is wise for whatever path they've ever gone down. And I think I can relate to them on that level more than I can, you know, hey, guess what I read yesterday? Fucking yeah. Fuck school.
So given that that's the comedian that you are now, is that the comedian that you started off being?
No. I actually started off I knew I wanted to be in show business, okay? I'm one of those guys. From when I was 10 years old, I was acting and all that, and I was always an actor foremost. But the funny part was, is my dad listened to comedy albums. I had comedy albums coming out my yin yang, like when I was a kid. But it never occurred to me to fucking comedy in 70, you know, when you're fucking what, in 79? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't even have occurred to you to become a comedian. But lots of acting, little theaters and all that sort of shit. That was a viable thing. And I was pretty good at it. And plus, I realized that if you are in show business, you'll be able to, I've always said this, you'll be able to maintain your high school lifestyle forever. Yeah. Okay. Like, that is the one fee that not a lot of people realize about this business. And so when I first got into comedy through a friend and all that sort of stuff, I kind of fell in love with it. I wasn't a comedian in the beginning. I just liked the fact that I could be the director, the scriptwriter, the star, everything. To me, the way I viewed it in the beginning was it was like a play. It was like a big-ass monologue that I'll prepare, and I'll go out there and I'll wow these people. Yeah, you know what I mean? And that's all I knew of it. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So when I got into it, but the thrill of being my own director, playwright, really fucking turned me on. it was only later that you find the mechanics of comedy, in fact, take you away from acting, you know, because acting, you have to be a different person. You know, you have to step into somebody else's shoes, whereas comedy, you have to really find who you are, because if you don't know who you are, you'll never be able to project what you want to say to these people. It'll always seem a little bit phony to me anyways. Yeah.
So how long did it take you to find who you were?
About
you...
fucking long times too.
Go on.
I died for about 10 years, man. Fucking, I drove 9 hours to die in front of a bunch of hillbillies up in northern British Columbia for fucking no money. But I mean, I was a kid, and not only did I have the fact that I didn't know who I was at 19, I didn't know who I was on stage or anything. I was just reaching, trying to fucking build anything I could, you know. Like, but eventually, if you do something long enough, you get good at it. And the thing is that I've been around for long enough to actually get good at this. Most people, they'll try it for 3 or 4 years because they think it'll be a job or something like that, and then they'll quit. But this business is all to me about longevity and not profile, all that sort of stuff, because it's the same as you sitting there going in and being a mechanic for the first day. Do you know what I mean? You'll go in, you won't know how to fucking build an engine. But if you're hanging around that shit for 10 years, not only will you be able to build an engine, you'll be able to build the fucking best engine, you know. But if you quit after 3 or 4 years, you know, you're never going to be able to build that engine. So you have to have that passion to keep going. So
there are presumably people who've been going for 10 years who are still bad and shouldn't be doing it. Are there?
There's because, tons of those guys.
Yeah. So what differentiates the person that keeps going? In what way were you keeping going? Because I totally appreciate what you're saying, but it's at the same time, we both know it's not just about turning up every day. So
it kind of is, though, Stu. It kind of is. The one thing that they haven't changed, you know what I mean? The people that are bad that have been doing it for 10 years, they've been doing the same thing, hoping to get a different result. That is the difference. I mean, if you're in this long enough and you hang around with the right people and all of a sudden you learn from, like, all the masters of the road, like, everybody I've ever toured with has affected me. Do you know what I mean?
What kind of names are we talking about?
Well, I mean, obviously, like, one of my biggest ones is Craig Campbell. He's, like... He was the one that introduced me to comedy and all that sort of shit. I go way back with him. I mean, even you to an extent, too. I mean, we've gigged. I even remember your first gig. You used to walk on super fucking confident. And I remember your gig because you'd walk on going, I'm so fucking good looking. And you would be like fucking all about the, because you came on with arrogance. That's how you were going to fucking get these people. You were going to do this arrogance and show how preposterous it was. Do you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
I remember. Ridiculous! I really tried to make that I'm good looking angle work for a long time.
Yeah. Now we're doing podcasts. Thank you. It's what I do.
If anyone's listening along, playing the Com drinking game, finish all of the drinks.
Yeah, they just haven't adapted. They haven't. They haven't learned, so they probably, you know, haven't been with the right people yet. But that may change. I mean, no one says that it's the timetable of 10 years either, Stu. We're not saying there's a cutoff point. Maybe that person that's doing it for 10 years is a slower learner than everybody else, and maybe it's going to take him 20 fucking years. But if he loves it that much, he'll keep going at it, you know?
Tom stayed then. What a wonderful comic, and what a riveting interview right from the start. I was so excited when he said that, just that very first thing about wisdom. That's such a good point. And I mean, I know, to those of you who don't know him and who haven't necessarily seen much of his act, that premise of, are you someone that talks about things in your life or are you life? That's going to sound very hippy-dippy, kind of new worldy, new age kind of philosophy sort of stuff. But I think it's a really good point. And I've been reflecting on that a lot just in the last week or two since doing that interview. When writing new stuff, I've just been thinking, yeah, it's not only about making... It's not only about talking about the things that are going on in your life, which is something I would imagine almost all of us do, but actually trying to reach beyond that and aim to represent. And it's impossible to talk about without saying something awful and pretentious like the human condition. But that's it. Are you life? Are you something in which life experience is distilled and therefore visible and accessible to people listening to... Listen, if you're listening to the episode, you're getting all of this said much better than I could. But I'm really excited about this one, and I'm sure you guys will be too. Only two little things, really. One, of course, thank you for the donations. They're really helping the show. I hope you can tell there's a bit of a difference in sound quality on these blurbs, because I'm recording them with some very nice new microphones that I was able to purchase with your donations. So thank you. That really means a lot to me. You can, of course, donate any amount, however large or small. Just go to comedianscomedian.com, click on the PayPal button. I am making a personal pledge that by... Now I'm talking in personal pledges. I've got to think of timing issues. By what? Issue 100? That's got to be possible. By issue 100, I will have sorted out global world pay subscriptions, because it does... PayPal insists on giving you a little box you can tick that says make this regular, and people use that all the time. Despite my protestations to the contrary, it has never worked, and it's just an unending series of emails between PayPal, you and me, whereby it just explains why it can't work and no one knows why. So avoid that misery. But by episode 100, I will have tried very hard to either set that up, or I will, or you will know the reason why. So that's all of that. Yeah, thank you. Pay as much or as little as you like. And do remember, as ever, that your donations pay for the people who can't afford to donate. There's a lot of students donating me £2, £3 or £4 here or there. That's really kind of you guys. I really appreciate that. And equally, there are people in exciting, far-off places with names like Hoboken, or Hoboken possibly, that was from last week, wasn't it? Or someone in Cape Town and someone in Auckland recently donated, and someone exotic like Western Supermare. So thank you for those donations as well. £1 a show, if you think that's reasonable, or whatever amount you'd like to give. And that's at comedianscomedian.com. You can tweet me at ComComPod, or my own Twitter is at Stu Goldsmith. They frequently say the same thing. So if you follow both of them, that must be tiresome. I can only apologise. And I am now going to do a bunch more. I'm in a Canadian mood because of Tom. I'm going to accept new submissions now. I've been kind of referring, I've been building a list in the past, but at the moment I've got a couple of names on those lists, a couple of people I'm contacting at present for the next run of episodes. We all know Phil K is going to be episode 100. I've got a few more to do until then. I know I'm going to be away with Prince Abdi in the Middle East in a couple of weeks, doing some Comedy Store gigs out there, so I'm hoping Prince will come on the show. And there's a couple of other sort of people that are floating around my mind, but now is the time. At ComComPod or info@comedianscomedian.com if you would particularly like to recommend someone. And as we've done in this episode, as Danny Davis in Wolverhampton very kindly put together this live event, if you're a promoter and you fancy putting on a live thing, which basically from my end of it is plug and play, so you handle the promotion, you sort the room out, all the rest of it, you sell the tickets, and then we'll organise some sort of a split between you, me, the venue and the guest, then I can just turn up and we'll organise someone for me to do. If you'd like to do that, remember Paul Savage did that for me before with the Gary Delaney episode. There's a couple of others in irons in the fire at the moment for those. But if you would like to be one of those people, then just get in touch. And just in a, this is, some of you will know Oliver Double, who wrote this fantastic book on stand-up comedy that I and a lot of my contemporaries read years ago. He is now setting up an archive of stand-up comedy material, and you can email Ollie and his colleague Nick Hiley, standup@kent.ac.uk. So Ollie now is a lecturer at the University of Kent and teaches, I believe, a stand-up module there. So if you would like to donate any of your stuff, now I've had a brilliant conversation with Ollie about this, but it's things that you would love to see. Like I remember seeing Noel Fielding and Lee Mack do the Comedy Zone years ago in Edinburgh. I don't remember the year. I don't remember who else was on the bill. Apologies if it was you. But it was mostly memorable for Noel Fielding having a horrendous death to everyone apart from me in the audience. And he ended up delivering the entire set to me. And it was crushingly awkward. But this is sort of pre-fame kind of level, obviously. And I would love to know who was on that bill. I'd love to remind myself what the poster looked like. This is what the stand-up comedy archive will be able to achieve. If you've got any recordings of yourself, if you're professional, if you've got any kind of material you haven't made available in the past, any archival stuff, you can send it to standup@kent.ac.uk. I'm sure they'll be accepting scans or whatever you of physical, you know, visual documents. Old, I love looking at, you know, some clubs like the Banana Cabaret in London, of course, the Comedy Store. They've got fabulous old black and white 10x8s on the wall from comics, and you can look at it and go, oh my God, that's what whoever Steve Coogan looked like 25 years ago. So anything, if you've got any stuff like that, probably if you're going to send them huge files, email them first and check, but it's standup@kent.ac.uk. They'd love to hear from you. I think that's a brilliant enterprise that I'm very happy and proud to be supporting. I've only recently started chatting to Ollie. I've not even met him in person yet, but he seems like a really nice dude. That is everything for the moment. Join the Facebook group. You can get a little sneak peek there at the Phil K episode, a little unreleased thing. It's a little treat. And let's get back to the brilliant Tom Staid.
So for those 10 years of Northern British Columbia and all of those kind of things, just take us back to that sort of that time on the road. What kind of lessons were you learning? What things were being knocked off you? What obstacles were you taking out of the way between you and your funniest self?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think you start by the lifestyle is the thing that is your first big change. You know, to me, being on the road and living this life of awesomeness, not having to go to a 9-to-5 fucking job, frees up your thinking because you don't have to be polite to anybody. Do you know what I mean? And I don't mean it in a bad way, but you have to work with, when you're in 9-to-5 jobs, you have to deal with other people and you can't be offensive to them, which blocks your thinking. Do you know what I mean? I've said horrible fucking things to me that aren't even fucking horrible, but to this douchebag over here, he would go, fucking, how can you even think like that? And when you're on the road with other comics, you know, in a car for 7 fucking hours, and you're in this environment where everybody's just talking about everything, nobody's fucking judging your thoughts or anything like that, and then you do the show and you get to be drunk and get to feel awesome and then come up with all these wild ideas while you're super high and rock starry. And I think that's the start of your change because I learned at a very early age to go, fuck you. You know what I mean? And that to me, not fuck you in a bad way, but I will not bow down to that way of thinking. And I think I can break through your barrier to go up. Okay. So I think that for me, it was the lifestyle that changed my way of thinking, you know, because before that I had to work with people and yeah, I had crazy ass thoughts, but nothing like hanging around with Craig Campbell's and JP Masses and all of a sudden fucking you're talking. Fucking, see, I'm scared to even tell it to you on your podcast. All of a sudden, you're laughing at rape, which is a biggie nowadays. You know, I'm not saying, you know, anybody listening to this podcast is going to go fucking, they're going to hear that one fucking word. But the one thing that it is it's the absurdity of the idea that mm-hmm. most comedians make fun of. You know what I mean? The absurdity that we humans do this to each other. You know, and the more you shy away from not talking about it, the more it actually wins. Okay. But you have thoughts, you have freedom thoughts like that you wouldn't normally get working for the Native Monster. Yeah. You can't sit around fucking just having conversations around the water cooler talking about rape, can you? Huh? Oh, he doesn't talk to anyone. He's probably the rapist. Watch out, ladies. He's going to put his penis inside you when you don't want it. Fucking, I don't have to. He's reviewing you. And then the rapist wrote this.
I mean, there's a chance I'm going to need to put some explanatory notes with
the release. Of course you are.
Of course you are,
because that shows you how weak the people that are listening to this. You got to put an explicit thing, like they think that you're not allowed to talk about this sort of stuff and all that. To the fact that you would even have to put a warning for somebody just shows you how far most people's minds can go. If you warn them, then it's okay, but you just can't spring it on them because they couldn't handle it. And I agree with that. You should put a warning on this because I'm going to come and rape you.
I just
for I'm the... fucking dead on that.
Just for the record, the explanatory notes I meant were going to explain the reviewing the guy setting up situation. But I do. I mean, there's a whole other conversation to be had about the context of rape jokes. I think
I don't want to go there. But what I'm saying, because let's not that. It's just there's certain ideas out there. Okay, let's not
Absolutely.
Just focus on that one. There's tons of them that are like that. Do you know what I mean? And it is our job as... Anyways, to go back to your original. So being able to work with these guys freed me up to be able to think about these things without having fear of thinking of them or to think that I'm a weirdo just because I think of these thoughts. I mean, so that was probably one of the bigger transformations for me was just the lifestyle itself. Starts providing your material and who you are going to become. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
There is a thing, so there's something I've observed about the Canadians in the UK circuit, which is a good thing that I've observed. That I've always, I mean, the Canadian acts that come over here and come to my attention at least, and there may be more than I'm aware of, they tend to be really, really good. Okay. And I wonder, there's a lot of other kind of speculation for that. I talked to John Hastings recently on the podcast. We were talking about the elements of having to travel a very long way, a much longer way than most UK comics have to travel, in order to get the gig. That means you absolutely have to get paid because you're making such an effort. That was one of them. From what you're talking about now, there is something about that environment of comics in a car traveling for 7 hours. You probably don't have those free-ranging, ideas-based conversations in the first hour of the journey,
no.
Which might be all that a British comic gets.
Well, again, here... Okay, well, I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in this idea. When you travel, it all depends also who you're traveling with. There are comics that don't like to share ideas because they take this business very... They seriously, and any idea that they have, they will want to claim and all that sort of stuff. So if you're in cars with guys like them, you get nothing. You know, you're usually, let's turn on the radio and, hey, let's not say nothing to each other. Mm-hmm. Let's not be honest and all that sort of stuff. And then other comics that you're with, you will get into that conversation within the first hour because you enjoy their company and all that sort of stuff. I think it's who you're in that car with will give you what you're looking for or not give you what you're looking for. Do you know what I mean? So I don't think it's the fact that you're in a car with 7 hours. Imagine being in a car with 7 hours with somebody who doesn't want to fucking open up.
I've done that.
Yeah, man. That's like 7 hours of, okay, more Radio 4. Mm-hmm. And this guy, let's talk about whatever the fuck he's talking about. Uh-huh. You know, so I think it's the people that are in that car that make that journey fun.
So we're talking about the kind of the creation of, I was going to say the creation of your persona. I think in the terms that we're talking, that's not right. Yeah. What we're talking about is the removal of all the stuff in between what you were doing, your earlier stuff.
Here's the other thing. I took it a little too far too, Stu. Like after a while, you can only do so many drugs and drink so many beers and shoot so many whiskeys before the lifestyle can take over.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
There has to be that balance, man, because you know, for a long, you know my reputation in this business. Not a lot of people want to on TV want to work with me.
Is that I didn't know that was
well. It's not that. It's just I'm a dangerous person, man. I could. For the BBC, I could throw a fuck out at any moment, and all of a sudden they will get letters from people who paid £100 not to hear Tom say fuck on TV, and you know that's they're just saving their ass, so there's no worry. But sorry, Stu.
No. You go ahead. You were talking. We'll just digress briefly. Given the nature of your act as something that is that comes from a place of being free, and part of that freedom for you might be drugs or alcohol, or you know, being on stage, being drunk on stage, which I've only ever done once, and it was amazing. I didn't want to do it again because it was amazing.
It's a skill I think every comedian should fucking learn, man. I really do. I think you going on after smoking a joint or having a few beers and instead of trying to do the act, trying to pretend to be sober to do your act, which always fails, but if to go on and actually just be in the moment of being drunk and having a bit of a fun with these people instead of taking it so seriously is a skill in itself, man. I mean, I'm not saying like do it on the Apollo. You know what I mean? But if you're in a back room fucking, you know, in Wolverhampton where there's fucking 5-10 people, get fucking hammered. See what you can do. Fucking nobody's going to give a shit. And you're going to learn how to just be in that fucking moment, you know? Be like I always said, you know, fucking before I go on stage, you know, you don't know what Tom you're going to get. You might get drunk Tom. You might get stoned Tom. You might get Tom who's just been in a scrap with his fucking wife for 2 hours, told her to fuck off, slammed the door, and I'm going to make these people fucking laugh. But I will ride that emotion with the material that I'm doing, you know? So, I mean, instead of trying to recreate the same thing all the time, you know, I try and make each show as individual as I possibly can because of that. Yeah.
Just to talk briefly about when it doesn't work, you know, about when you
let everybody down.
When you let everybody down. No, I'm well. We can talk about that as well. I mean, are there times when drunk Tom has been too drunk to perform a decent act?
Totally. There have been times that Tom has fallen off the fucking stage drunk. Fucking and you know what? By all means, fucking everybody at that show will remember that show for the rest of their lives. But then again, okay. Now we're moving into back then. Yeah, I might have felt something for it. You know, I don't really. My body can't take the same lifestyle anymore, Stu. I still try. You know what I mean? I still fucking try to be that dude and all that. But it just. My lungs can't handle the same shit as they used to. But what did you just say?
We were talking about has drunk Tom ever let people down?
Oh yeah, totally. But as I've grown a little bit, that's when I wanted to do good. Okay, in the terms of letting people down, I don't even think about that anymore, because what I think about now is there isn't a good or a bad show anymore. Okay, to me, something's going to happen. I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to be with it, no matter what the fuck it is. It's going to happen, and I could be dying, but you want to know something, Stu? I die very fucking well. Okay, dying is an art form on its own. Okay, whether you're fucking Doug Stanhope, I love to see that cunt die. I love to see him fucking hammered, and I love to see him piss the fucking audience off, because there's the connoisseur in me that is fucking going, that is so fucking good, you know. But now I don't think I would get so drunk on stage that I would fall off. Not like when I was 22 going, fuck you, cunt. And then just, you know, again, who gives a fuck if I got fired today? I mean, I'm not.
Is that purely because your body can't take it anymore? Or is there any other, I mean, do you ever feel like emotionally connected to having, do you feel that you've let down audiences or promoters or yourself or your financial responsibilities or missed out work that would have been useful for feeding your family? Do you know what I mean? Do you feel that there are elements of that where you've overdone it, or do you feel like, hey, that was, you know, that's just the gig, whatever, I'm like, that's the gig?
Yeah, yes, Stu. But the goals were different back then. Do you know what I mean? The goals, when I did let them down, I really felt for it. You know what I mean? And when I did let them down, you're right. Like I was still a starving comic going to the people, so I needed those gigs. I fucking really needed those gigs. And if I did let a promoter down and never got to work in that club again for however fucking long it was, they always ban you and then, you know, see you 7 years later. Like, are you still drunk? What? Back then, I did. Do you know what I mean? But now, Stu, now you got to understand that I've also grown from that. And I'm glad I experienced all that sort of stuff to the point where I don't... It probably would never happen again now. But the funny part is that now I go into rooms not caring if I get fired or not, because I think that frees me up. But when you're talking about back then, yeah, you're right. It did fucking affect a lot of things, man. I mean, it was the bane of my existence, like to sit there and to be known as the drunk stoned comic that has followed me my whole career and all that sort of stuff. And to not be able to change in front of these people is a very hard thing to deal with.
To not be able to change.
Well, yeah. I mean, to sit there, just the same way as we were talking about who you were, and then you change from that person to this person. That person also changes into this person. Do you know what I mean? 40. It's my birthday today, Stu.
You mentioned.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming and doing this on your birthday.
44 years old, and I've been doing it since I've been 18. And you know, even that person, that 20-year-old party reckless motherfucker, has changed into this 44-year-old that can use all that stuff that I've learned piece by piece, get rid of what I don't like about myself, take what I do like about myself to create this person right now. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm never not going to go on stage and fucking, like I say, people are people. You know what I mean? And to sit there and have a good time, have a couple drinks before you go on and all that sort of stuff. Just be with them. They're having drinks. You're having drinks. It's a fabulous time. But I don't think I'd ever go over the edge like I used to. But like I say, it's weird that before, when I did go over the edge, I cared about being fired. And now that I don't go over the edge, I don't give a fuck if I do get fired.
So, okay, that was going to be my next question, which is that when you do big TV spots, things that are important, and you've presumably got management and career opportunities riding on it and stuff like that, given
profile,
the big
hunt for profile, yeah. Isn't that fabulous?
We'll talk more about that in a moment, but when you are doing those key profile-related gigs, somewhere where there is a risk of, you know, you like a situation in which you have to do well, are you able to be as free on stage as the 22-year-old don't give a fuck, I'll say anything? Given that you're, you know what you're talking about, this sort of sensual experience of let's see where this goes.
Yeah.
Can you still have those kind of gigs under the pressure of a film crew and a rehearsal and having to hit your marks and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, of course you can, man. Yeah. Now you can. Like those, because if you don't free yourself up for them, you're gonna look really monologue-y on TV and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you still have to have that fun element within. I mean, when they ask you to do those shows, they ask you to type up the script completely. You know this as well as I do. They need the lawyers to do every fucking check. Can I say that word? Oh, can we use that word? It's the BBC. Can't say a store or we might be promoting it.
Can we take this perfectly good word that makes the joke work and change it to one that doesn't?
Totally. Great. Fucking perfect. Yeah. Thank you. And but the sense of freedom within that I still have because of all those times, you know, like the sense of freedom of going up there and maybe I will change a word once I get up there. I will fight the system just enough so I win, but they won't attack me. You know, so that's what I think. But you're mentioning the, you know, these big gigs that build you up and you know, the agent's gonna you know, that you do great on this gig, all of a sudden you'll be famous and you get everything you fucking want, and because that's everybody assumes that that's what I want is fame, and fucking I don't want it. I mean, I'll take it if it comes my way, but I won't go fucking chasing after it after all these years. Do you know what I mean? To me, it's the art of comedy that I enjoy the most, and that idea that you're chasing this thing that once you get to fame, then what do you do? Then what do you do? What do you do when you reach the end? Whereas if you just kind of look at this as an art form, it never ends. It never ends, and fame will come, and fame will go, and money will come, money will fucking go. But in the end, you just have that art form. Like when, like I achieved all my goals when I said I want to become a comedian. Fucking done, sorted. Goals are sorted now. It's just really get into the heart of this fucking beast and figure out how it works and be the next comedy Picasso.
Let's talk about the craft of writing the stuff. So something that you did in the sort of brief kind of new material performance before this, mm-hmm. You said you had some ideas here that you're going to sort of play with, yeah. And we played with them. At what point do you write stuff down physically? Do you just have it all in your head? Talk us through. You've got it. Like, are you doing Edinburgh next year? You're going to write another? Okay,
yeah,
so you're going to write another hour from now. What's the process look like now for that stuff?
Okay. Are you ready for this?
I'm totally
Are you really ready for this?
Because
I learned something about 2 years ago that I didn't realize. For the most part, everything I write, I don't ever sit down to write anything anymore. I used to. But I still do keep a pen and paper beside my bed because most of my thoughts come at the end of the night and I'll roll over to Trudy and fucking tell her something funny and she'll go, would you just fuck off? You know, like... I'm a photographer. I don't give a shit about your job. And I go, that's why I love you, baby. But I, most of the things come in car rides with you. Most of them when I'm walking my dog. And we have this fabulous thing now called the iPad with iNotes that before you used to write them down in your little book. Always had to carry your little book around and write all those things down. And then you now I got the iPod. And what happens for me is I'll have two or three lines that I'll write down, and I know I gotta get from A to fucking B to C, and then that's what my amateur nights are for. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To go into these amateur nights and just mess around without any expectation, any free, you're just free to fucking talk, and you're not looking for laughs, you're looking more for the comfort in what you're going to say. Do you know what I mean? I'm not looking for the laugh. I'm looking, how comfortable am I to be able to say this without it seeming joke for me? Do you know what I mean? So it seems like it's a nice idea and all
so
that.
So you need
sort
to actively stay away from something that sounds like a joke.
Yeah, well, not really. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I'm not looking for the funny when I start. What I'm looking for is the comfort of being able to say it. You know, what am I trying to say? And I'll go on stage like and talk about one of my ideas, and then I'll come off stage and I'll go, I don't even think that's what I was trying to say, so I'll try it again until I can feel the flow of what I'm trying to say. Okay. And then what I've done is I used to have a tape recorder, right? Everybody always hears that. You're a new comedian? Yeah? You fucking got your tape recorder, all that, so you can listen to the joke and listen to where the funny was, okay? And one night I decided to videotape myself. And it was probably one of the, you know, those eye-opener moments of boom, you know? So I taped myself video, and I went home and I watched it, and I realized something, that I am now watching what the audience is seeing. Do you know what I mean? But I'm also knowing something that the audience doesn't know, is I'm also knowing what I'm thinking about on that thing. And I found that what I was looking at never matched the delusion of what was going on in my fucking head.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? So all of a sudden, I started looking at myself, because on a tape recorder, you can still have the delusion of what you are because there's a laugh. But when there's a video of you and you're watching yourself, you think to yourself, why didn't I go farther with that fucking joke? Why did I chicken out there? Why was I scared? I learned that about myself on those things. I learned that whenever I'm uncomfortable with a joke, I'll start holding this microphone like this to pretend that I'm fucking comfortable and all that sort of stuff. And as soon as I saw that, you know, all of a sudden that microphone went behind me, and all of a sudden I was freed up to do these things, to do whatever joke I was, so I didn't have that, and I had to really delve into it. But I found that the more, now this is the way I write, right? You ask me, now what I do is I videotape any of the ideas and I start matching what the audience is seeing instead of the delusion, you know what I mean? And what I do is I can see what they're seeing, and I see what I should have done there, what I shouldn't have done, how I should have been thinking at that point. And all of a sudden, jokes get really good really fast. Do you know what I mean? Because now I'm actually watching what I need to do instead of listening to a tape recorder going, oh, that was really funny.
That's what you mean by the delusion, is you can listen back to it and go, oh, I've heard that laugh, therefore everything must have been okay.
Yeah, it matches what's in my head, and it's the rock star that I am. You know. But how many people do you know that come off stage that went, that was fucking dynamite? And they fucking bomb completely.
Yeah, right.
And there are tons of those guys. But that video camera thing, because most comedians don't like looking at themselves, because that delusion will fucking, if they have to see the delusion, it'll destroy them. Mm-hmm. It will fucking, as long as they keep that delusion up, it's always the audience's fault. You know what I mean? But once you break that illusion down, then all of a sudden you have to take responsibility for what's going on. But you can, because you can see what they're seeing, and you can give them what they want out of you. Do you know what they want? You to be brave. They want you to risk. They want you to do all that sort of stuff. And until you actually physically see it, then I don't think you can give them that. You know, you can't see what they're seeing, you know?
Are there particular topics that you think of, that you spot and go, like, in terms of this, taking a starting point and turning it into a Tom Stayed bit?
Right.
Are there topics that you think are particularly Tom Stayed?
I find what makes my material me is I don't too often stray out into any world that isn't right around me. Okay, if it doesn't affect me, I will not really talk about it too much. Do you know what I mean? You know how most people talk about what's on the TV, even though I did Undercover Boss, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But it still was one of those things that it's something, you'll never see me commenting on the Iraq war too often. Do you know what I mean? But everything around me is me, which pretty much is, I talk about like family. I'm really big on exposing the inner psycho in relationships. Like you guys all think I'm a really cool fucking dude, maybe. Okay, but my wife knows what kind of a fucking psycho I actually am, and I know what kind of a fucking psycho she is. But to everybody else, we're normal fucking people. Mm-hmm. And I like to expose the psychoness so most people don't feel like they're fucking psychos, that it's happening. You know, we're all psychos, so let's just be okay with psycho. And anything that kind of involves my world, do you know what I mean? So that would be my trope, I think. Mm-hmm. Is that like, because I don't really stray from this, you know? I don't really stray from what's going on within Tom's world. When I watch news, I there was a play I saw. I watched a play, and I thought it was a great quote when on the play he said, the newspaper, he goes, that's just other people's problems. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I don't really feel like fucking getting into other people's problems because I got a shitload of my own that I'd like to unload on
okay,
you people.
Okay.
So that would be my trope. So I pretty much write about, you know, family. I mean, going to markets, meat vans, just really fucking, that's right. That's the joke that made me famous. One joke, I had a hit song, and all of a sudden, now I'm just proven not to be a one-hit wonder. Kind of fucking, so it's just all that sort of stuff around me. Whereas you take another guy, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I have to use, like, you take a guy like Brendan Burns or one of these guys, and they'll talk about the world.
Yeah.
And they'll bring their opinions on how they could change the fucking world. And I'm right. I'm just trying to change my world. Comment on this world that is going on right in front of me. So that's when, now whatever that entails, you know, I'm always surprised. You know what I mean? There'll be a new topic coming along that'll go, I can't believe that was even in my world. You know, mm-hmm. So but for the most part, I like to stay internal. Yeah, that's a good way. I like to be internal instead of external. You know, so I pretty much comment on my human condition, hoping that my human condition. I'm not the only one going through this. And when I spew out my human condition, if people laugh, then I know I'm not the only one going through this. And I think when you do write a joke and you're talking about yourself, the really good ones, the really good jokes that you write is when they're listening and instead of seeing you in the story, they can see themselves in the fucking story. And that's like that's a kick ass. That's the meat van joke in itself. Like when I tell that joke, nobody ever really talks that I'm the one in it. Mm-hmm. They always come up to me and tell me about a fucking meat van that they've been at. And it brings them into, you know, so that joke isn't really about me. They've seen themselves in that joke, which makes it a fabulous fucking joke. And I don't just look like some dickhead who, you know, thinks I know what to do about the Iraq war. I'll stick to meat vans. So,
if anyone has a question, please feel free to raise a hand. After these 10 years of being bad, was there a particular epiphany where something clicked and you got better, or was it a gradual process?
It's definitely a gradual process. No, but I didn't wake up and all of a sudden, boom, I'm writing fucking dynamite jokes and that sort of shit. You know, like you
bad luck comics who've been shit for 10 years.
Yeah, bad luck. No, it's a gradual. Like you'll write your first killer joke. Do you know what I mean? Eventually, you'll write your first killer joke that you can't believe works every fucking time. And you will take that and then you'll try and write another one like that, and you'll wonder why you can't do it. But then all of a sudden you write that second one, and all of a sudden it gets a little bit easier as you go along. You start understanding how to write that joke for you, you know, and eventually, you know, you build up probably your first half hour in all those, and I really mean that, fucking, if you're starting from scratch, not knowing comedy, and you get to a half an hour in 10 years, I'm really impressed, like a killer, because you could tour off that for years to fucking come. But what it is that you start writing that first great joke. And then all your other jokes pale in comparison to it, you know, because now all of a sudden you've got a great joke and the rest of your jokes are shit. And all of a sudden you've given the rest of your jokes a reference point. You don't like the rest of your jokes, so you got to fucking scrap that and scrap all that other shit if you're brave enough to fucking do it and try and figure out why that joke is so great. And that takes time, man, because the reason it also takes time is because when you're starting, you don't gig every fucking day. You know what I mean? Like, I know guys that wait 6 fucking weeks to get their next gig, you know? And so that's the time that it takes. If you were gigging every day, it wouldn't take you fucking 10 years. But because you're gigging once in a while, you know, and you're building yourself up, that's why it doesn't happen overnight. It's a real gradual thing that you do, and then eventually, once you get 20 minutes and then people start noticing you, I think that's when the change comes, because then you get more gigs because you finally worked up to a nice 20 that everybody's happy with, and you can start, you get a little bit of recognition and all that sort of stuff, and then the process starts speeding up. Does that answer your question? Like, was it a good answer? Okay, I hope so.
This is your first gig.
Your first gig, you're going to be floundering like a fish on fucking land, trying to breathe, going, what the fuck? What the fuck? And 5 minutes is going to seem like a fucking eternity. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is going to, you're going to sit there. You think you got 5 minutes of material. Once you get on fucking stage, all of a sudden it is going to go down to one, and you are just going to be coming up with ideas, going, this is how to build an engine. And all of a sudden, you've got Lego pieces going, what, is this guy a retard or something? You know, but the thing is that the thing I love, the thing I've always loved, the one thing I will tell you is because you are a late bloomer and you haven't learned to tell people to fuck off. Okay, you've actually been around appeasing people for your whole fucking life, making sure, like you say, making sure you don't get fired, you know, so, you know, you can't show up to work drunk and pass out and all of a sudden the stapler's attached to your fucking forehead and you look like a loser and you get fired. You've had to appease people for a very long time, and you're coming into a business where you've got to break those barriers for when you, so that's going to be a hard time for all the people that I've ever seen start late. When you're 18 starting, it's really easy to go fuck you to the world, but you have those morals and manners ingrained in you that you are going to have to really fucking break off and say what is on your mind, because I bet you when you're sitting there in your bed or whatever, the thoughts that go through your mind, all the thoughts that go through your mind that you say, I can't tell anybody about this or they'll think I'm a fucking weirdo, those are the thoughts that you got to bring to that fucking stage and break that fucking fear that you're going to have. And I know you're going to have it, you know, but if you can do that, then you're on your way. And you know what? Fucking enjoy starting it off, because it's so much fun experimenting. You know, I have expectation now, which I fucking hate. That's why I go on stage not caring that I get fired anymore, because that expectation makes you shit. But if you go up on stage not giving a flying fuck and you know how to build an engine, and if they don't like your engine, they can go fuck off. You are such a, in the beginning, it's such a fun time, you know, just having a fucking voice out there and having a whole bunch of people actually listen to any fucking thing that you have to say. So you got to really revel in it. And like I say, tape yourself. Watch how fucking retarded you look on your first day. you'll piss yourself laughing, man. You'll go, fucking. But at least you'll see. You know, you'll see what you're doing. It'll speed things up for you, man.
That is a new question to the podcast. So the question is, when people suggest a topper to one of your gags, how receptive are you if they're a punter as compared to how receptive are you if they're a comic?
Do you know what? Do you know, I've never actually, to be real honest, I've never actually thought about that. So this is my first time, and when I go home tonight, I'm going to go, why the fuck did I say that to her? But I think as a comedian, you can differentiate that the joke that the punter gave you is good enough for your act. I mean, just because you are a punter, but most people, you know, the punter, that's such a weird word, because I don't want to insult punters, but. You know, they have an idea of what comedy is as a punter, and there may be comedy geeks out there. Probably all of them are listening to this podcast, and it all depends on what the punter says. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, you could probably have somebody. I mean, you know what? Actually, as long as you tell me something, and I really like it, and I think it's funny. I don't think I give a fuck where it comes from, as long as I'm not stealing it. And I think the biggest thing that you got to worry about with punters is you don't know where that tag came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You don't know if that is from somebody else's act. Whereas when you get an idea from a comedian, he sort of has a general knowledge. He's been around. He's seen all the different comedians, and he knows that this isn't a hacky line, or this isn't stolen from somebody. So I think the only question you have to ask when you get with a punter is, where did the line come from? And you always got to be a little bit skeptical, because you're wondering if that person is really comedy savvy, or maybe he just lucked out, and that's fantastic. But I wouldn't dismiss it, not at all, because some of my best friends who aren't comedians we've had some wonderful conversations where they've given me brilliant lines, and they're not comedians. You're just in that moment of laughing your fucking guts out because you've just smoked a shitload of weed.
If you believe in a new idea and you try it and it gets nothing, do you try it again? How many times do you try it again before your belief in it
fades with everybody else?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? That is that. I don't think that has a time limit, my man. I think that is all up to you. You know, some people have this rule that they'll try it 3 times. I don't know if you've ever heard that. I've heard that lots. I'll give that material a 3-time shot. Some people will defy the audience, and even though they think it's funny and it never fucking gets a laugh, they will say, fuck you, I'm going to do this joke till I die, and I'm going to find one audience that thinks it's funny, and then I'll abandon it to prove that I was right. But that is funny.
Yeah, yeah. See
that? Fucking, that's a real inside comedy. That's inside. But that is a real personal thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is such a personal battle you're going to have with that material. You know, to me, you know, if I think it's funny, you know, fucking, I'll never give up on it. I won't bring it to the forefront, but I will work on it until I get it right. And I'm still one of these guys that goes to amateur nights every Monday. You know, like, not a lot of everybody thinks that I just go and do the big show, but I mean, even on this tour, I can't wait. The show that I'm most excited about are my Monday night 10 minutes of me being an amateur again. Do you know what I mean? Because you got to get rid of all your material, and once again, you don't know if any of this shit is going to work, but I'm a better mechanic than you, and I'll get this engine fixed faster than you will. But I think that's a real personal thing, and I don't think there should be any rules behind it. But if if in the beginning, okay, you're trying to get work and you can't really get it going, just put it on the back burner, man. Do you know what I mean? You can also do that. Nothing's saying, like, I mean, actually, that's interesting. Nothing's saying, like, I've got joke books from, like, 20 years ago that I wrote ideas that I could never make work back then because I wasn't a good enough comic. But I'll look back on them and go, oh, fuck, that's a great idea. And then I can all of a sudden make them work. So you give them, you try them. And then if they don't work, just put them on a back burner because maybe you're not at the right, maybe you're not a level 20 comedian and you're not allowed, that's a Dungeons & Dragons reference. That's how geeky I am. I'm a level 20 comedian, okay? I've got spells that you level ones can't even use. Thank you. I got artifacts and magic staffs. You know? So I think that's a real personal thing, man. And yeah, that's what I think about now.
As a very final thing, what would be your final message to comedy? What would be chiseled on your comedy gravestone? What's your one piece of wisdom that if you could impart one thing to prospective comics on how to do it?
I say this all the time to every nervous comedian who I try to... I've always been a nice guy, Stu, you know.
Yeah,
you
were very
me.
Nice to me from the first day you got in my car, and like, lit up a joint and then asked me if I minded.
Because I there's no competition with me. I think there's only art, so I don't think anyone's doing better or worse than me, and everybody's on their path. And what would be on my gravestone is something that somebody told me a long time ago that changed. That was a turning point for me, and it would be, if you're going to be a star, you might as well start acting like one. That would be on my gravestone. If you're going to be a star, fucking act like one. Don't sit there and be fucking nervous before you go on stage. Do you think Burt Reynolds gets fucking nervous before he goes on set? Fuck not, man, but I see all these great comedians with balls of fucking nerve that stop them from having fun and just sticking to their material. So when he said, the guy that said it, I'm not going to say it because it's a name dropper, and it's a big one. But when I was so nervous that day and he came up and told me that, it changed how I go on stage now. I go on stage like I'm a star. You know what I mean? Whether I am or I'm not, who gives a fuck? You know what I mean? But I might as well go up there and act like one. And eventually, if I act like it long enough, that invisible world will eventually match the visible world, and you will be the star that you need to become. But until you start acting like that, you're always going to be a fucking amateur now, aren't you?
Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Stay.
I can't believe anybody gives a shit about my opinions.
So thanks to Tom. Thank you to Danny Davies, who, as I mentioned, organised and promoted this live special. I really enjoyed that. That's an episode for me that I can feel is already having a lasting life outside of the interview. Do you see what I mean? It's one of those ones you go, I'm going to be thinking about that a lot in days and years to come. If you're a promoter who would like to host one of these ComComPod live specials in your city, email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Thank you to Ben Lund Conlon for the Podmin for this episode, which was co-produced by Nathan Wood. We're back next week with the rubber-legged amphibio clown, Trigvi Wakenshaw. It's a fabulous conversation with a really lovely, very, very funny man. He's almost like, I imagine in advance that some of you will perceive him to be a bit like a Dr. Brown that doesn't hate stand-up. Now, I'm misquoting lovely Phil Burgers there, but you remember the response to his episode about comedy. I know he doesn't hate stand-up, but Trigvi, I think, has a much more... I'm not going to say he's warmer than Phil. I think Phil is a very warm guy, but Trigvi is much more... He's loose and gangly, and he kind of gets involved in a way that I think you're really going to find fun and very instructive as ever. So that's all for now. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. I'll speak to you soon.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.